Welcome to Sex with Simmery. Frank, occasionally explicit edutainment on the most important topic of all. Sex with Simmery is not intended for children and is not safe for work unless your boss is particularly awesome. See more at sexwithsimmery.com.
Hey, Sex with Simmery people. You should totally come join me at the Philadelphia Podcast Festival. It's August 1st through 3rd at Philomoka and PhillyCam. You can come out and see three nights of great Philly-based podcasts, and they're recording their shows live in front of you, the audience. The lineup for some of the shows includes Talkadelphia, Story Shuffle, Talking Nerdy, The Pincushion, Stark Raven Mad, Potent Brew, and of course me, Sex with Timmery, and more. Plus, there's going to be special guests, contests. I'm bringing pole dancers, y'all. There's going to be a whole lot of excitement. So find out more information about the shows and tickets at phillypodfest.com. Welcome to Sex with Timmery. This is Dr. Timmery, and I am super stoked to introduce to you Dr. Yvonne Fulbright. How are you doing?
Yeah, great. Thank you.
So,
thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I've been excited to have you on because I actually saw you give a keynote at a careers in sexuality conference to like just a huge mess of people who are all going into sexuality. And it was really inspiring to me because you were just like real goddamn practical. I appreciate that about you, like a whole lot. So
yeah, pretty realistic, because I think a lot of people get sucked up in like being the next Dr. Drew or Dr. Ruth and thinking that it's really easy, not realizing that it's a lot of work, it's a lot of networking, and that there's also plenty of work to be done on the more, you know, ground level, like with real people every day instead of always, you know, with the media giving messaging.
That's a really huge component. I think like the sort of field of sexuality education gets sort of bifurcated that way. It's like, are you actually interacting with humans or are you telling humans what to do, like from afar?
Right.
Yeah. I think that was always like my beef, actually, speaking of Dr. Drew, is that like he had no experience in sexuality education at all.
Like, yeah, I think his background is addictions. That was his specialization as a psychiatrist. And, you know, there are lots of wonderful health professionals out there, your doctors, nurses, and so forth. And the public assumes that they're a treasure trove of information around sexuality issues, not realizing that most of them have never taken a class in their lives on that issue, on that topic. And a lot of them are very uncomfortable. And we have plenty of other resources in sexuality out there. And so the challenge is to find those, you know, the good ones, and then also to work with healthcare practitioners and, you know, their educational systems as far as making sure they're better resources than what they've proven to be so far.
So what is your background? Because right now you are all over the place. I mean, you've got a really impressive background of like, what is it, 9 books at this point? Something
right, yeah. Like that. I do a lot of writing.
Yeah.
A lot of writing, both, you know, columns and books and articles, as well as teaching with American University, Penn State University, Argosy University, both online and in the classroom. But I, you know, I'm originally from Iceland, and I moved to the States when I was going through puberty. I was like the first girl in my class to have breasts and all of that fun stuff. And I realized even at that age, and I was like 10, 11 years old, that the messaging I was getting from my Icelandic mother and from my relatives back home in Iceland around sexual development, becoming more sexual human being, was very different, much healthier, more natural, normalizing than what I was getting from American society peers. Of course, my friends' parents were very uncomfortable with me being like the first signal to them that their kids were going to be next kind of thing, and all of the can of worms that would come, you know, with that next stage of development. But when I was then going through high school, I went back home to be an au pair for my cousin Eithis in Iceland, and her good friend Jona Ingibjörgjónsdóttir was Iceland's first educated sexologist, and she had gone to this University of Pennsylvania program that used to exist, which offered masters and doctorates in human sexuality education. And so Eithis said, you know, I could see you doing what Jona's doing, and I knew about the Penn program and just thought, you know, I need to get myself there, because there is, as you know, so little out there as far as formal education. And it's kind of like finding a needle in a haystack as far as good programs go.
Well, the Penn program is actually now at Widener, which is, yeah, which is where I went. So
No, it was an incredible faculty that took it from Penn to Widener when Penn wasn't willing to support it anymore. And I know that it's really blossomed at Widener and offering actually a lot more than what the program could when back when I was, you know, in graduate school.
So now you're all over the place. You got a ton of books and you've got, you know, columns and teaching, and you're the sexual health and relationship ambassador for AstroGlide.
Right.
I
yes.
Love it.
No, they brought me on board at least a couple of years ago because, as I've also learned with other companies like condom companies, you know, lube companies, sex toy companies, like the general public thinks because they deal with things we use when being sexually active, that they must be experts on sex. So they get slammed with questions all the time. And nobody on staff is educated in, you know, sexuality education and therapy. So they'd wanted to bring an expert on board to help them out. And actually, if you go to astroglide.com, then you can find me there, the Ask Yvonne link, and send questions your way to anybody, you know, anybody who's listening now with us.
I love that, like, you're the ambassador. Like, I love that there's ambassador in the title. Like, you get to go to the UN and like hand out condoms to somebody from Burkina Faso. Like,
that's a pretty cool title, and you know, it's also very it just creates warm feelings. Like, an ambassador is always somebody looking to, you know, do some good, relate and work with people, make things better.
Yeah, there's so much terminology. There's the coaches and the counselors and the therapists. And, but like, yeah, I want to be an ambassador. I'm going to go to ambassador school and I'm going to figure out how to make that happen.
Awesome. Right.
One of your newer books, this is so interesting to me. And I know that it's every person I've ever heard of who's even heard of orgasmic pregnancy is like, what? Because it's like sort of a revelation. And can you talk a little bit about that book and your involvement?
Well, a few years ago, now my good friend Danielle Cavallucci and I wrote the book, Your Orgasmic Pregnancy, Little Sex Secrets Every Hot Mama Should Know. And it was because Danielle was, had just given birth and felt like a lot of women were really ill-informed or not being empowered as far as their sexual urges and longings during the 9 months, you know, that they're expecting, still considered a very taboo topic in a lot of ways. And then, you know, with my background being in sexuality education, we thought we'd team up to write Your Orgasmic Pregnancy, which has been really well received because so many women do experience increased libido, do want to have sex a lot more, are having maybe the sexiest or most erotic dreams of their lives, and they're not really understanding what's going on to them, or they're made to feel like freaks by even their own partners for the fact that they just can't seem to get enough satisfaction. So this book was really an effort to try to set the record straight, to use on the little bit of research that's out there, affirming that for a number of women, there is increased libido and the desire to be more sexually intimate, and to just help women feel good about their sex drives no matter where it's at during a pregnancy and then the postpartum period.
Did you find that there was, a lot? I mean, how much research was there, and what kind of questions had people been asking? And I mean, I feel like there's so much mythology around that.
Right. Well, honestly, there's not a lot of research, but of course, the biggest concern is, can I even be sexually active during pregnancy, especially after the first trimester? Because so many healthcare practitioners will say, you know, proceed with caution, or it's a good idea not to have sex. And, you know, they're just ill-informed or misinformed. And of course, there are certain circumstances where a couple should not be having intercourse or should not be working towards peaking necessarily in being sexually intimate. And they really have to redefine or expand their definition of sexual intimacy beyond intercourse and certain activities, and have it just be more about, you know, outer course and so forth. But that's always the first thing of concern, you know, is can I be sexually active? And then what positions can I get into without worrying about harming the embryo or fetus? To can I use sex toys? And if so, you know, how do I keep them clean so that it doesn't result in infection, and things along those lines.
And the women who were interviewed, are most women like willing to just go ahead and give it a shot, or are people scared? Like what's
all over the place. And a lot of women feel really good during pregnancy because they love how voluptuous their bodies become. They love that it's easier. You know, as far as things like lubrication, there's always already a lot more blood in the genital region. Probably the biggest complaint we got with sex during pregnancy was the fact that a lot of women didn't feel supported by their husbands or their partners, that the men were having a bit of a Madonna complex. You know, I can't touch her because she's carrying my child or because she's with child, or having trouble finding her pregnant form attractive in a sexual way, you know, feeling that that was really taboo. For some reason, for some women, if their libido wasn't high, it was still hurtful if a man wouldn't be interested in being intimate in almost any kind of way, versus on the other end, the woman who was like feeling like she was clawing at herself or her partner all the time, feeling like she was exhausting him, or that he was turned off, that she almost had too high of a libido for his tastes, or, you know, become too sexual in a very short period of time. At the same time, we also had interviewed some of the dads and got a really wide array of responses from admitting, you know, it's hard to see her as a sexual being when she's with a child, to I loved it because I no longer had to worry about pregnancy because there's already a bun in the oven, or, you know, we no longer had to practice safer sex. So sex was a lot more freeing that way, to, you know, we had a miscarriage the last time. So that made me really tentative with her because I just didn't want to do anything that could result in that kind of misfortune again.
That's like a lot of pressure. That sounds incredibly scary. And I mean, I think I've heard like bits and pieces of all of this just throughout the world from people, but yeah, there's like no unifying, you know, understanding. I don't know that we actually really do talk about it nearly enough for as common of experience as it is.
And the thing that's so fascinating is that the research shows that couples who maintain sexual intimacy throughout pregnancy do better postpartum. And that doesn't mean that they're necessarily always having intercourse or oral sex or whatever, you know, their pleasure is, but it's that they're still cuddling, kissing, being intimate in some form on a regular basis. And they're the happier ones at the end of the day. So it's really important for couples to make that time for each other. It makes then the reconnecting after birth much easier.
So here's something that I feel like for many women is an incredibly big concern, and for men I've definitely heard discuss this as well, the idea of if you observe a childbirth, like how that changes your perception of your partner and your sexual attraction to them, because I've heard a variety of answers. And I actually was just reading a book where one of the characters, like, literally after seeing the birth of his child, like, never again was attracted to his wife. And I think that's a really big fear. But I've also heard people who say the exact opposite. Or, like, it was the most powerful thing I've ever seen. She's such a badass. It's so cool. Like, I mean, did you hear a lot of different answers, or...
Yes, we did cover this topic in Your Orgasmic Pregnancy because we had also heard the same thing, you know, a lot of different answers, but, you know, it is very individual. And for example, I went through a phase where I was working with the American Medical Student Association quite a bit, and with that had dated a couple of medical students. And, you know, these are people who eventually learn to, you know, help give birth and, you know, bring babies into this world. So if that's what they're used to, it's not going to maybe gross them out or be as much of a turnoff to somebody who, you know, can't, for example, give blood because they're afraid of passing out. So everybody's going to have their own threshold. Our recommendation in the book was, you know, stay up at the, where the mother is, not down below. Because like you said, a lot of people have a really hard time seeing their playground kind of ripped to pieces. And, seeing the mother the way they did pre-pregnancy in a sexy way.
Wow. Yeah. It's so pregnancy. Like I just have so many like feels and not a lot of thoughts, because I feel like it's just so compartmentalized and so medicalized and so removed away from our own control and real discussion. Like, it's I'm glad that people talk to you about it. Was there like fear about this? I mean, were people just like ready to tell these stories? They'd been waiting.
Oh, yes, especially, you know, Danielle's circle in New York. I mean, she'd been pregnant up in Brooklyn and had cultivated a lot of friendships with other women who were expecting. And you know, that was part of our original inspiration, was just the fact that there was a need for this kind of book, from women, you know, being able to share each other's stories and experiences and then letting the rest of the world know, like, hey, we're here and it's okay. And, I wasn't pregnant at the time. I was, though, after working on the project, looking forward to my first pregnancy to then, you know, hopefully experience an out of control libido. And I ended up having the opposite experience. Like, I was one of those women whose sex drive plummeted throughout pregnancy. And, that was a disappointment. But it also allowed me to relate to the women who do have problems in a way I couldn't before as a professional. So that's been really helpful to me, both personally and professionally.
Why do you think that there are abundance of books on pregnancy that are available for people, and especially in terms of like what you should be eating and, you know, exercise and mm-hmm. a lot of that kind of stuff. Why is there such a dearth of information on this facet of pregnancy?
I think it's just people are afraid to handle it. For example, one of the most popular pregnancy books out there, I think, deals with sex in maybe 2 pages, and it's like a really thick book. So it's just a real sin. I think it's also that people in the society have trouble seeing a pregnant woman as a sexual, sensual being. You know, it's that whole thing of like mothers aren't supposed to spread their legs kind of thing, not realizing that, you know, happy couple makes for a happy family. And it's really important for couples to, support each other, even if it's not easy, but in the very least, you know, feel good and get their hands on each other in a very feel good kind of way, because just simple touch can be incredibly physically and emotionally supportive. A simple massage can make all the difference in the daily experience that you're having and the way you feel about your partner.
Were there any patterns you found in which sort of people had the better outlook, the more continuously sexual, the more sensual experience? Who had an easier time with that than others?
Well, I will say that there is kind of no rhyme or reason. You would think that somebody like myself with a background and sexuality and being, you know, rather open-minded and open to the experience of an orgasmic pregnancy would have had just that. So, I think you can have all the best intentions, and just Mother Nature sometimes has a different idea of what's going to happen to you. But I did find with the people I interviewed that if they did come from a more religious conservative background, like Catholicism, that, or if their partner did, then that was what made for a more challenging situation. That's which isn't really surprising.
Because I was wondering, because it's like, on one hand, it's like, so yeah, because there's all that, you know, Madonna horror, like straight from that sort of thinking. But at the same time, in the religious backgrounds where you're supposed to have a lot of children, there's got to be, on some level, you're pretty cool with like banging a mom because you got to have like 8 kids. Like, yeah. So I was curious.
Exactly. You know, one of my really good friends from high school had told all of us back then that she wanted 13 or however many Whoa. God would give her. And she's like one of the few like really practicing Catholics, as in like does everything that the religion preaches. And I think she's pregnant with number 8 right now. And, Whoa. You know, that's my thing. Like, she's been married since college, and it's like, you know, they must have a really good sex life.
Or they're just
especially
fertile.
Women don't, you know, conceive every time they have yeah. sex. Like, more power to them.
Yeah. I mean, so like, there's a lot of things to say about like the Duggars with the, what are they, like 16 and counting? I don't know how many they have now at this point, but I mean, that is admirable, like the amount of, if not attraction, at least they feel an obligation to be good to each other in that way, I guess, hopefully.
Exactly. And, you know, that kind of like allows us to transition to the related topic, which is then, okay, after the baby is here, and you know, usually women get clearance to have sex again about 6 weeks after giving birth, depending on how well the birth went and so forth. But, you know, I have been more impressed with women who end up then giving birth 10 months later, you know, those kids that are only 10 months apart. Because I'm like, how in the world did they have the energy? They must have taken one for the team, because, you know, with a newborn baby and sleepless nights and your body's still recovering, you're just exhausted. And it's like, there's no way sex could be on the brain. And, you know, so it, I just feel like it must be, you know, the partner was like, oh, come on, you know, it's been a little while. And of course, a lot of people think that breastfeeding means you don't have to worry about birth control. And you know, while it's very effective, you do need a backup. A lot of people, you know, also I think that you can't get pregnant so soon after having just given birth. And I think, you know, depending on a woman's menstrual cycle, when it kicks up again, it could be as little as 2 weeks later that you can be fertile.
The term Irish twins comes to mind.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
That sort of thing. Yeah. So now you are in the position to not only say as an educator, but also as a person,
right,
the postpartum sexuality. How does it change? What are the different things that you expected and did not expect, and any surprises?
Well, honestly, how much being sleep deprived affects everything else. I remember years ago, a friend of mine said, you know, good health starts with good sleep. And she was so right about that. You know, if you can't take care of that part of your life, it's hard to take care of everything else. But I would say on a very related note to being, for the postpartum experience being exhausting, is the breastfeeding experience. And that actually does tend to lower women's libidos. There's, you know, some hormonal differences impacting that. And it being critical to start using lubricant at that point if you never have before. I mean, you know, lube's amazing for enhancing touch, whether, you know, it's getting your fingers down there or making things tastier during oral or getting things even wetter during intercourse and so forth. But it is critical when a woman is postpartum, and especially if she's breastfeeding, because you are much drier down there. So lucky for me, I get hooked up with all these Astroglide products as their ambassador, including this really new sensitive skin gel that they have, which for women like me who have sensitive skin just gives like the extra reassurance. But I was always a big fan of lube before, even a bigger fan in needing it during a very, you know, critical different time for my body.
So this might be skipping ahead, actually, or going back a little bit. We didn't really talk about birth itself, and this sort of is reminding me about just the concept of orgasmic birth.
Right.
How much did you find about that?
Well, I had read up on that quite a bit. I was really curious about the phenomenon. And for women who do, there are women who experience it naturally. We're honestly not quite sure why. It might be where the head is pressing up against a couple of the major nerves down there, and maybe that's what's triggering orgasmic reactions. Some women might even feel that they're in more like one with the universe kind of state, with the ecstasy of giving life, and that could be part of it. But honestly, the key to it is that the woman's clitoris is being stimulated. And, you know, some women have had like a doula or midwife or whoever's open to that, thinking it might help facilitate the birth process. Others have their partner there doing that so that she doesn't need some of the drug, you know, painkillers. It's kind of like a natural painkiller. And then, by the way, it helps you also orgasm. You know, my husband and I had talked about it, but I just felt really overwhelmed. It was like first pregnancy, first kid. I didn't want to worry about that on top of everything else. And I think also where you're going to give birth is a huge part of it. And I went the hospital route, whereas people who pursue orgasmic pregnancies tend to do it, you know, in a private area or in their home, in a midwifery center kind of atmosphere. You know, your average doctor at a hospital is not going to be down with it.
No, I don't imagine.
Yeah. And, you know, plus mine ended up being C-section, unplanned. Oh. And that just, those two aren't compatible either.
No. Like, it's interesting because I'm curious how much of it is, like, in the natural state of pregnancy, like, taken away from how we have compartmentalized it and medicalized it and all of these sort of things. Like, is that a much more organic reaction to have? Or is it that we keep giving ourselves, like, stripes to earn? Like, it's not enough that you're bringing a baby into the world. Like, you have to do it with panache.
Yeah.
Like, and I don't know, like, what is the more realistic outlook on that?
You know, I just think it's allowing yourself to pursue what's comfortable for you. And I admire the women and couples who feel like that's a really important part of a more pleasurable birth experience. But like I said, for me, it just would have been one more thing to worry about, one more thing to then have to plan around, one more thing to have to set up, you know, and of course, probably practice for as much as you can, which maybe isn't such a bad thing. But you know, I think people are often so into keeping up with the Joneses and coveting what other people claim to experience instead of just sitting with themselves and being like, you know, what's right for me? How can I make something work for me? What can I be satisfied with given my capabilities, experiences, desires?
Yeah, I'm just the whole thing. I want more information. I think you're on the right track here. I'm really excited that this entire topic is coming up. So just a little bit more on now, the postpartum situation. Like, what do you recommend? So we've got the lube definitely is going to be more of an issue than it might have been before, and the sleep deprivation sort of situation. But do you have any other like advice or are there other concerns that people might just be aware could crop up?
Sure. Well, I think it's very important for couples to communicate. I mean, you know, in any situation, it's necessary, especially in avoiding problems. But people do make a lot of assumptions about what's going on, especially when there's a lack of intimacy. Like, you know, he doesn't seduce me anymore because he no longer finds me attractive, or you know, she doesn't want me anymore because she never touches me. She's all about the baby these days. And letting your partner know how you're feeling and why can help both to avoid a lot of distress. And, you know, letting your partner know, I still find you attractive, or I still want to be intimate with you. Or, you know, I'm just so absorbed in being a new parent or having another child that I just need to not be intimate with you for a little while. But don't take that personally. Those are very important conversations to have in more than one occasion, too.
I like it.
And then, of course, planning a date night, you know, even if it's just a couple of hours, try to find a nice escape for dinner or a beverage. And, you know, that also don't have to, like, put pressure on yourselves to go for a quickie. It could be just, you know, being able to go for a walk together and holding hands, or, you know, giving each other back massages, or just doing something really nice. It's just about the two of you. I would also say plan for privacy. It can be really hard to create a space in your house that's baby-free, but try to have a room or area where you don't have to think about baby every time you look around, that you feel you don't have to worry about things like waking the baby up because of noise. Make sure you're armed with enhancements. I mean, not just lubricants, but maybe a vibrator or those other things that can really help to get things going and to facilitate them, especially if time is short and you're a little stressed about the baby waking up at some point.
Very practical. I appreciate that. That's awesome. So obviously people are going to want to learn more about you and read about the other things you've written about. So where is the best place to head to find out more about you, Yvonne?
Well, my website is YvonneKFulbright.com. And of course, astroglide.com has a link to some information on me, as well as the services I offer with Astroglide, like the Ask Yvonne and the monthly newsletter with tips and articles and so forth.
And where all are your columns running right now that people might run across you?
Well, honestly, the writing's been hard to keep up with in being a mother, but in addition to astroglide.com, I occasionally post to psychologytoday.com, the Mate, Relate, and Communicate column, and then huffingtonpost.com.
Very cool. Well, I think that there's plenty of reason why you may not do writing in the next couple of weeks or anything, but
that's the thing. It's all about enjoying this time period and re-strategizing priorities, and I'm very lucky to be in charge of my schedule in a way that a lot of other parents aren't, but this is a very special time, and it's just about finding balance in a whole new way and realizing too it's a very temporary situation. Things will change drastically with every year, and that couples just need to be communicating openly about the challenges and then the barriers, and then also what you have to be thankful for and the things you look forward to every day when you get up.
I love it. Beautiful. So thank you so much for all this incredibly interesting stuff that we've probably never talked about on the show. We've talked a lot about birth control, but never actually like what happens if you're like not wanting to use birth control. So
Right. Yeah. If you want to start a family and all those challenges.
Yeah. Crazy. Think about that. Imagine sex and babies somehow being related. What? Yeah. So very cool. Thank you so much for all this really interesting information. And obviously your ambassadorship, I want to doff my hat to you, Miss Ambassador, also Dr. Fulbright. So,
thank you. Well, it's been a pleasure, and definitely be in touch.
Awesome. Thank you so much, and thank you everyone for listening. Have a great day. Thank you for listening to Sex with Timory. Sex with Timory, the podcast, is produced by Nathan Karuna. Our opening music is by Charles Evans. Our closing music is by Hanya Lee. Be sure to check out sexwithtimory.com, Sex with Timory on Facebook, and tweet at me, Timory_LEIGH. If you're a fan of the show, if you like it at all, a little bit maybe even, rate and review us on iTunes and tell your friends all about it. And thank you. Hey, Sex with Timory people, you should totally come join me at the Philadelphia Podcast Festival. It's August 1st through 3rd at Philomoka and Philly Camp. You can come out and see 3 nights of great Philly-based podcasts, and they're recording their shows live in front of you, the audience. The lineup for some of the shows includes Talkadelphia, Story Shuffle, Talking Nerdy, The Pincushion, Stark Raven Mad, Potent Brew, and of course me, Sex with Timory, and more. Plus, there's going to be special guests, contests. I'm bringing pole dancers, y'all. There's going to be a whole lot of excitement. So find out more information about the shows and tickets at phillypodfest.com.